The number of seniors struggling with where their next meal will come from has increased dramatically since 2001, some even having to choose between buying food or medicine.
And I think that's a lot of times why we see such a large population of seniors at our pantries, because they do have to make that really tough choice because medicine is very expensive.
Plus, a new report finds Illinois has been getting worse at helping low-income students obtain a college degree.
You know, just the disparity between low-income students really across race that are completing at a rate of about 37% within 6 years. So that completion gap has to become really a priority for our state.
And there's a new law that doubles the amount of hunting permits for bobcats this season. Bobcats used to be an endangered species in our state. We're going to be talking about all of that coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay with us. The latest news is next. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Seniors in America and in Illinois continue to face very real difficulties in meeting their food needs. In the rural, central, and southern parts of our state, for example, where the nearest grocery store might be miles away, access to food can be particularly challenging, especially for someone who's much older and perhaps living alone. On a national level, roughly 15% of all senior citizens are close to hunger. That's nearly 10 million people. That's according to a recent report from Feeding America and the National Foundation to End Senior Hunger. And the greatest sub-demographic at risk among those elderly populations, it's low-income individuals and racial or ethnic minorities. On the line with us now from Urbana to tell us more about food insecurity among seniors is one of the co-authors of that report, University of Illinois Professor Craig Gunderson. Krista Lisser is with us as well from the Central Illinois Food Bank. Craig, Krista, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here with me.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Craig, let's start with your research. A big part of it focuses on the term food insecurity and learning more about its health consequences. First of all, can you define for folks who aren't familiar what the term food insecurity means?
Sure. Food insecurity means if somebody is food insecure, it means that at some point in the previous year is they have not had enough food for an active, healthy life. And so it's based upon 18 questions on something called the Core Food Security Module that's put out by the USDA. And every year there's an annual report that gives us numbers for the country as a whole. And then in the report you just referenced is we break things down for seniors in our country.
And what do we know? What's the extent of food insecurity among seniors in the country?
So if in our report we measure three things. We measure the threat of hunger, the risk of hunger, and facing hunger. And when we think about the risk of hunger, that's what's generally known as being food insecure. And we find that 8.1% of seniors in our country are food insecure, which amounts to 1 in 12 seniors are food insecure.
1 in 12. Do you find that this is getting better or worse?
Okay. The good news is that it is getting better if we define it as the proportion of seniors who are food insecure. So from 2014 to 2015, is there was a drop in the number of seniors who are food insecure. So that's the good news. The bad news is that despite the end of the Great Recession in 2008, when we saw large increases in food insecurity, both among seniors and amongst the full population, is the levels in 2015 have not yet gotten back down to the 2007 levels. So that's the bad news. Even though we are doing better, is that we're not doing as well as we were before the Great Recession. Another thing to note is that there's been a huge increase in the number of seniors who are food insecure in our country since 2001. So in 2001, there was about 3 million seniors who were food insecure. By 2015, this has risen to almost 6 million. So it's been almost a doubling of the number of seniors in our country. And that's due, one, to the fact that there's just more seniors than there were previously. And two, overall, there's been an increase in food insecurity rates. So food insecurity among seniors is a serious, serious issue in our country.
When it looks like, as you're saying, 2001, obviously that tracks sort of along economic recession levels, right? So after post-2001,
right,
when we saw the economy go down again with the Great Recession, it makes sense, right, that the most vulnerable are disproportionately hit harder when there's an economic recession. And that's kind of what you're seeing, right?
Right, right. In terms of the post-2007 story, right.
Krista, you're on the front lines of this. Once a month, the Central Illinois mm-hmm. Food Bank holds healthy food distribution events where you literally hand out tons of food, about 12,000 pounds in just less than 2 hours. How many elderly folks are you seeing at these events?
You know, during the past year, and sometimes it can be more than once a month that we do these events, but in general, yes, it is once a month. In the past year, we've seen nearly 4,100 seniors that have come through the food distributions on a regular basis. So, you know, I guess as a whole, it's been 4,100 seniors. And a lot of times those are repeat customers as well. So we're not talking about they come once throughout that whole year. They're usually quite a few times.
And what proportion, so when you say you see 4,100, how does that compare to the rest of the population that you have? Folks that you're feeding, how many of those people are older people?
Yeah, you know, according to the hunger study that was last done in 2008, about 16% of our food insecure population that we cover here for the Central Illinois Food Bank, which is 21 counties, is food insecure. So that's nearly 18,000 senior citizens that are food insecure in our 21 county region.
Krista, I know when we talk about the issue of food insecurity, a lot of people may not realize that the demographics are often people who have college degrees, people who are working. What does it look like when we're talking about food insecurity among the senior population in Illinois? Are they also, what are the demographics?
Multi-generational households a lot we see. We have grandparents that are taking care of grandchildren that extra mouths to feed. So a lot of people think seniors and they think maybe they live alone, they're widows or widowers, or there's just a couple, especially you know, in multicultural families, you have a lot of multi-generational households. So you will see grandparents having to support grandchildren, which creates more of a strain. And there's a big SNAP gap there as well. So they don't get enough SNAP benefits to be able to feed their whole household, especially if they're taking care of more than just themselves and a spouse.
Craig, when we look at programs like SNAP, the Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program, I wonder what it looks like in terms of the government landscape and benefits for people who are part of the elderly population. And then, of course, when we use the term seniors, I think there's a lot. That's a huge term. It can mean lots of different things.
Right.
People who are recently retired. What are we talking about? People who are living in long-term care facilities, people who are living on their own. Who's most likely to be food insecure when we're looking at this senior population?
Okay, so looking at among seniors is, as you mentioned at the outset of this, for example, African Americans have higher rates of food insecurity. Persons who are divorced or never married have higher rates of food insecurity. Those with lower incomes have food insecurity. And that matches what we see in the general population. One thing, though, that was perhaps surprising about when we look at seniors is oftentimes people think about the face of senior hunger being, you know, somebody who is homebound and 78 years old. However, what we actually see is that younger seniors are actually at higher risk of food insecurity. So, for example, in 2015, about 9% of seniors between the ages of 60 and 69 are food insecure, whereas if you look at those who are over the age of 80, is you're looking at closer to 4%. So those older seniors have more than double the rates of food. The younger seniors have more than double the rates of food insecurity than the older seniors.
And Craig, what does Illinois look like? How do we compare to other states when we look at our populations and people who are in need?
So the good news is Illinois actually does pretty well. Is our rate of food insecurity among seniors is 7.7%, which is, as I mentioned earlier, is lower than the 8.1% that we see for the country as a whole. So that's the good news, is that, you know, Illinois on average does quite well. However, is, you know, for some of the things, you know, that Krista just talked about, and for some of the things that I've talked about here, is that there are many seniors who are still have higher rates, you know, higher rates of food insecurity, and that average to some extent masks the serious challenges that a lot of seniors in our state face.
Krista, I wonder, when we look at the budget impasse and how much that affected social service agencies throughout the state, how has the Central Illinois Food Bank seen need change over the past year or two? And has it settled down in the past couple of months since there's been a budget agreement?
It's almost kind of been a constant steady for us, really, even with a budget and without a budget. You know, as Craig mentioned, we really, especially downstate, have not fully recovered from the recession. There are a lot of rural communities that have not seen the impact that some of the other larger metropolitan areas have of the economic, you know, boost, that if you could call it that, obviously not as good since before 2007. So, you know, we still see a large amount of population, especially seniors, coming to pantries. And I don't think the budget impasse has necessarily helped that. It probably has slightly, but we still see a lot of people that still need our services on top of the other things. And a lot of things I didn't touch on before, a lot of times it comes down to people having, you know, especially with the elderly, having to pay for their medicine and pay for food. And I think that's a lot of times why we see such a large population of seniors at our pantries, because they do have to make that really tough choice, because medicine is very expensive, and a lot of people have to take it at that age.
Wow, that's a tough choice to think about, someone having to pay, you know, make decisions between medication or food. Krista, we talked about the healthy food distribution events. I wonder what else the Central Illinois Food Bank is doing, particularly when you're targeting the older population. I know, for example, we've talked in the past about partnering with events when we're thinking about college students who have problems mm-hmm. with access to food, having food pantries on college campuses. What does it look like when we're looking at sort of the opposite end of the age spectrum with older folks?
You know, we try to kind of that same concept, try to take many healthy food distributions, if you will, and take them to senior citizen housing and actually distribute food at their site. We've also partnered with two health centers here in Springfield, Central County's Health Center and SIU Center for Family Medicine. And we have now coolers in those facilities that contain fresh fruits and vegetables, thanks to a Walt Disney grant. So we have fresh fruits and vegetables right on site. And as you know, the elderly can make it to the doctor most of the time. They visit frequently, and a lot of times doctors will just say, you know, when we talk about medicine, food is a medicine as well. A lot of times people have ailments that they need fresh fruits and vegetables that they might not be able to purchase. So now they have access right at their doctor's office. So if the doctor says you need to eat more fruits and vegetables, they can go to the front desk and ask for some and get it right there.
Wow, that's great. Craig, what solutions do you think there should be at the in terms of the policy level, the state level or the federal level, to also work apart from what social service agencies are doing to help solve this problem?
The work done by Krista at the Central Illinois Food Bank, and the great work being done at the Eastern Illinois Food Bank, and of course the umbrella organization for all these Feeding America, is just amazing, and it constitutes a really critical component of the social safety net against hunger for seniors in our country. The most important component of the social safety net against hunger, and Feeding America would concur with this, is SNAP, Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, formerly known as the Food Stamp Program. This program is a quintessential successful government program insofar as it sets out its main goal is to alleviate food insecurity and hunger in our country, and it does a fantastic job at achieving that goal. If only all our government programs could be as successful as SNAP. So one challenge then is what we face is we want to make sure that all eligible people in need of SNAP are on the program. And one group of people that we unfortunately have a more difficult time reaching are our seniors. And this is for a number of different reasons. Probably the most important reason is that on average seniors out of this low-income population have enough income such that their benefit levels that they receive from SNAP are quite low as $16 a month. So what that means then is for a lot of seniors is they're reluctant to sign up for the program for such low benefit levels. So from a policy perspective, one thing that would be great is if we could, amongst other things about improving SNAP, one thing that would be great would be to increase the minimum benefit level for seniors, which would then hopefully draw more seniors onto this program, which would go a long, long ways towards reducing their probability of food insecurity.
Craig, we just have a minute left, so I don't know if you can answer this briefly, but when we think about the SNAP program and we think about what we've heard from the Trump administration about benefits and access, I wonder what you would say to folks who think that programs like the SNAP program are not effective and that they are just government handouts.
So SNAP is a hand up to people. It really helps people when they're struggling, whether it be for the near term or for a longer term time period. And many of those, so many of the things that have been said about SNAP just are not accurate. What I would emphasize about SNAP is that it's an amazingly successful program insofar as it improves the nutrient intakes of recipients, it reduces their probability of food insecurity, and it's so many other advantages. So if anything, we should be talking about improving SNAP, and that's one of the reasons why historically SNAP has had such strong bipartisan support. SNAP works.
And do you think that do you have a sense that that's also the same now in this charged political climate?
You know, I really feel that if you look at a lot of the things coming out of the House and the Senate on SNAP, is that I really don't think that they're, in fact, I'm certain they're not going to cut it to the extent that was originally proposed by the administration. So that's not going to happen. You know, I know that there's still talk of some smaller scale cuts, and I really hope that those don't go forward. But we won't see the huge cuts that have been originally proposed by the administration.
That's University of Illinois professor Craig Gunderson, who just co-authored this report about senior hunger. We will tweet out the link to that if you're interested in more. I want to thank Professor Gunderson for being with us, as well as Krista Lisser with Central Illinois Food Bank on the front lines of working with this issue. Craig, Krista, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
And thank you.
Welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Nyla Boodoo. It's getting more and more difficult to afford college in Illinois, especially if you're a low-income student. We know that student loan debt has been a mounting problem for students both here and across the country, but our state's financial problems certainly haven't helped the situation. And we're now starting to learn just how much of an uphill climb all of this can be. A new report from the Partnership for College Completion finds that Illinois public tuition and fees are the fifth highest in the country. African-American enrollment is down. The amount of annual income for low-income families that have to save for college has gone up to nearly 63%. In a few minutes, we're going to be speaking with the director of the organization that put out that report, along with a reporter who did this story about this. But first, on the line with me is Trey Slaughter. He's a student at North Park University, hoping to double major in history and education. Hey, Trey, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here with me.
All right. Thanks for having me.
So, Trey, you wrote for the Education Post a piece about how there were so many obstacles in your way to finishing high school. But you joined an organization called One Goal that helped you graduate. And when you got that high school diploma, what was your plan?
Correct. So One Goal assisted in helping me find a best fit college for me. And that best fit college at the time was McKendree University. And I went down there with a decent financial aid packet. And my hopes were to graduate from down there.
And what happened?
Unfortunately, even though the scholarships and the loans covered my tuition, there was a lot of other things that it did not cover, such as like books, just food in general, and living down there. Didn't cover a lot for me. Therefore, I had a lot of issues just paying my way down there in a sense.
So I can't imagine how tough it must be to think you're going to college and you've got it all set, and then you get there and you think, I don't have money for books. I don't have money for food. Is that pretty much what happened?
Yeah, in a sense. And although there were opportunities for jobs, they just weren't enough for me to make it by.
What kind of jobs were you working? What kind of ways? What kind of things have you had to do to pay for school?
Well, while I was at McKendree, I worked a couple hours in an art gallery. It wasn't really sufficient, but it got me through that year at least.
And at what point did you decide at McHenry, I can't do this anymore?
Well, it wasn't really at McKendree. It was the summer after McKendree. I was back at home. I guess I was living a little more comfortable of a life, seeing as how I was working and was coming home with a decent paycheck. So I guess I let that paycheck kind of get to my head in a sense, and I just said maybe instead of struggling and going into debt at school, I should just stay home and continue to work.
And then what made you change your mind?
Later on down the line, I ended up working at O'Hare. I was working, I'd say, almost 80 hours a week, and I just realized that that really wasn't a place that I wanted to be at anymore. I felt like I wasn't getting the professional respect I deserved, and at the same time, I felt like I had to earn more of that professional respect by going back to school.
And so why did you pick North Park? What was your financial plan this time around?
This time around, I chose to, I guess, put the idea of having money in my pocket, I decided to put that to the side or put that on the back burner, as I pretty much decided that what was best for me in the long run was better than what was best for me at the moment.
Yeah, so I'm speaking with Trey Slaughter. He's at North Park University. I wanted to bring two more people into this conversation. Kyle Westbrook is executive director of the Partnership for College Completion. They put out that report I mentioned at the beginning of this conversation about affording college in Illinois. Susie Yon's a reporter with WBEZ. Kyle, Susie, thanks for being here with me on the 21st.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Kyle, let me ask, as Trey was sharing some of the challenges he faced with going to college and paying for school, I just was thinking about how hard it must be for someone to put aside, to make the decision Trey made, because he was finally making money, but then he realized, okay, I'm going to have to go through a couple more years of not making a regular paycheck with this investment. How common are those stories, and how tough is it out there?
We hear those stories all the time from students like Trey, and we don't work directly with students, but we work with a lot of similar organizations. But we all the time hear of stories of students facing similar challenges where, you know, students get to college and they have a financial aid package that will, you know, either through grants and or through student loans or some combination of those things to cover the basics, cover their tuition, cover their fees. But oftentimes, those financial aid packages don't cover the sort of true cost of going to college, which include things like books. And if you're a student, depending on if you went away to school, there's often transportation costs that students have to factor into what the kind of true costs to going to college are. And often, we hear so many times about, you know, the ways in which our financial aid packages, even for our public institutions as well as our state institutions, just don't adequately cover the true cost of college and what it means to actually have a meaningful or full and rich college experience where a student like Trey would not have to be worried about food or would not have to worry about those sort of basic necessities. And I should note that, you know, in the state of Illinois, one of the things that our report sort of highlighted was that Illinois, especially when it comes to our state public institutions of higher education, our four-year institutions, is our tuition is fifth highest in the nation. And that's been a very slow trajectory, but it really poses a significant challenge for students like Trey, whether they're in our state public institutions or in our private institutions, when you add up the sticker price for college as well as those hidden costs that aren't quite as apparent that Trey obviously was confronting.
Yeah, Susie, you talked to a student named Eileen Ramirez, and she says, like, Trey, she said she's lucky, right? Because she was able to afford college, but her parents weren't able to pay for it. When you have students like Eileen, what were some of the ways she was able to make that work?
Mm-hmm. So she had just a patchwork of different scholarships and grants. And, you know, the way that her family helped out was, you know, allowing her to live at home while she went to school. So that cut down on room and board, obviously. But other things that she had to do, like Trey, you know, she had to pick up another job, even with that financial aid package, to make sure that, you know, she was making ends meet. And the MAP grant from Illinois, that played a big part in that.
Right. And let's talk about state finances for a minute, because I think folks who are familiar with the term MAP grant funding, because it was such an issue over the past 2 years with the state budget impasse and the crisis we were in terms of funding, different universities handle that different ways. Kyle, what about financial aid generally? What is happening in Illinois in terms of Springfield? Where are we at taking apart, let's remove the MAP grant funding, just in general, how does Illinois compare to helping students with financial aid compared to other states?
Well, historically, Illinois was, until the last 10 years, historically, Illinois had been really one of the leaders nationally when it came to providing need-based aid for students. And I'll just sort of go back in time a little bit to, you know, even when I was in college, which was quite a while ago in the early 90s. And this was true even through the early 2000s, where the MAP award in Illinois generally would cover almost all of your tuition and fees at a state public university if you are a maximum need student. And now we know that the MAP award will only cover about a third of the average tuition and fees for our state public universities. So what we've seen is the MAP award not only has the amount remained pretty flat since around 2002, but the number of students that actually receive the MAP has gone down quite significantly. Now we're down to a point that only about half of the students that actually qualify for the award will actually receive one, because the funds will just run out. You know, the legislature just has not invested in MAP over the last 15 years. Now, I should add that this last budget cycle, the state legislature did actually increase the funding to MAP award by about 10%, which is a really great first step towards making the MAP award what it was and what it could and should be for low-income students, which is a significant part of helping them to afford those tuition and fees.
And Kyle, how have you seen this affect particularly the African-American student population in Illinois?
Well, you know, it's always hard to draw kind of causal links, you know, that says that this is causing one thing or another, but I'd be hard-pressed to imagine that the state's precarious financial situation in higher education and the fact that so few students are receiving the MAP award and that the MAP award is covering less and less, I'd be surprised if there weren't some relationship between all that financial situation with MAP and the overall decline in African American enrollment in our state public universities. State public colleges and universities, including our community colleges, such that over the last 4 years, we've seen a 25% decline in African-American enrollment in our state public institutions, which is quite dramatic.
25%.
And quite 25%.
What? Is there a sense that they're just going out of state?
We're not quite sure. You know, that's something that we want to look into to find out where African-American students are going. But we've heard anecdotally from a couple of colleges and universities that we've partnered with, when they've looked at their data to understand where are students who did not attend their institutions going, what they've seen is students are just not going anywhere. They're just not enrolling at all. And so we're quite concerned, really, as a state. We should be quite concerned as a state with the, you know, declining enrollment in general across all, really across almost every demographic, really Latino students being the only demographic where we've seen significant increases over the past 4 years. We should be concerned about this decline, but this very steep decline for African Americans is one that we don't fully understand the causes of or where students are going. But again, we'd be hard pressed to not look at the fact that we're out migrating or we're sending so many students out of the state of Illinois to other nearby states and understand if there was, you know, are African American students part of that great out migration of students.
Trey, you're African American. I wonder about your class, if you can give us a sense. I don't know how your high school population, how many other African Americans there were at your high school, but where did your, I'm just curious your perspective on where your class went, how many people went to college or didn't.
So I went to school at Prosser Career Academy right off Grand and Long.
In Chicago. Mm-hmm.
So that school is predominantly Latino and Black. There are a few splashes of white ethnicities mixed in. However, for the most part, we are dominantly Latino and Black. I think for the most part, based off like what I saw, a lot of my fellow classmates, a lot of them went to college. However, there also are those percentages that didn't, or they did go to college and couldn't persist. And, that's just a reality for those students. And I particularly don't understand, like, their decisions for not going or their decisions for going and coming back, because everyone has their own.
Sure, everyone has their own story and their own financial situation and personal situation.
There's a couple things I would just add. It's just, you know, we spend a lot of time talking about the, you know, affordability and the access questions, but I think, you know, the crux of it is also the thing that Trey mentioned in his last remark, which is really about students persisting and completing, and, you know, just the disparity between low-income students really across race that are completing at a rate of about 37% within 6 years, compared to 75% of their higher income peers completing within 6 years. So that completion gap has to become really a priority for our state to close that gap, which would go a long ways towards what Susie was saying in terms of, you know, getting us to the point where we are at the 60 by 25. If we are able to close these very long and persistent completion gaps, then we'll make a lot of progress towards fulfilling our statewide goal.
Right. Susie, let me ask you, Illinois has set a goal for 60% of our adult residents to have some kind of career credential or post-secondary degree by 2025. Where are we at with that?
Well, it seems that number is lagging at the moment. As of 2015, we're about 50%, which is lagging behind the goal. And I will say that when people think of college affordability, you know, sometimes they think, well, maybe community college is an option. But as Kyle's group pointed out, students of color disproportionately enroll in for-profit and two-year institutions, and sometimes when they try to transfer over to a four-year institution, those credits don't always transfer over, and sometimes the student's achievement level is mismatched with the level of education that's provided. So there's another drop there in graduation rates, even amongst the wealthier or white counterparts to their peers, even in those institutions.
Lots of issues here that unfortunately don't seem great in terms of looking at public education and college education in Illinois. I want to thank WBZ Chicago's Susie Ahn. We'll tweet out a link to her story so you can see that, as well as the report put out by the Partnership for College Completion. If you follow us at 21ST Show, I want to thank Kyle Westbrook, who's its executive director, and of course, Trey Slaughter, who's a junior at North Park University. Trey, Kyle, Susie, thanks so much for being with me. I appreciate it.
No problem.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Not quite a year ago, something happened in Illinois that hasn't happened since the 1970s. In the first legally authorized season in decades, state hunters took home a whopping 141 bobcats. The elusive bobcat, once firmly listed on Illinois' threatened species list, makes its home in the woodsy northern and southern parts of the state, also to the west along the Mississippi River. Bobcats aren't huge. The biggest are just about 30 pounds, but they're hot commodities among hunters and trappers. A new law for this upcoming hunting season doubles the number of bobcat hunting permits available. We're going to talk more about what, where, and how people hunt in Illinois in just a few minutes when we speak with Mark Alessi. He's chief of the Department of Natural Resources and Wildlife Division. But first, we're speaking with Jennifer Carota. She's founder of the Illinois Bobcat Foundation, on the line from the Rockford area. Hi, Jennifer. Welcome to the 21st.
Hi, thank you.
Jennifer, as we mentioned, there's been some pretty big changes when it comes to the bobcat, Illinois. How did it become hunting of bobcats become legal again here in Illinois?
So in 2014 was when the legislation was first introduced. It was actually sponsored initially by Wayne Rosenthal, who was a legislator at the time. And it made it through, but it was vetoed by Quinn once he left office. And it was not much time in between Quinn vetoing it and leaving office that Rauner had legislation back on the floor. And, of course, it sailed through. And I think there was some questions on, you know, how people had voted. And there was concerns people had voted the wrong way and not understanding what the legislation was. And there wasn't a lot of time to hear in committee the reasons behind the legislation. So I think it was heard on one side, either the House or the Senate, and then it wasn't heard on the other side. It didn't ever make it to committee hearing. So then there you have it. We have a bobcat hunting season. In the first season, there was 500 permits issued, of course, and you just mentioned how many bobcats were taken during that season, and over 6,400 people applied for an opportunity to have those permits.
So I imagine from your perspective, the Illinois Bobcat Foundation is not happy about the fact that folks are applying to hunt bobcats in Illinois.
Right. You know, we're not an organization that is anti-hunting, but certainly I have some concerns about how this all initiated and was started, because even when I first heard about it, I just started a Facebook group, and that's kind of how I got started doing this. And it was because, wow, wait, there's enough bobcats in Illinois to hunt them? And I wasn't even aware that there was that many. And I don't think a lot of people are even aware that we have bobcat in Illinois. So it is a concern. And I think that there needs to be more science and thought put behind the current hunting season than what's going on right now.
So what would you like to see exactly then in terms of the science and data behind it?
Well, I think there's a lot of question as to really what the impact of having bobcat in the ecosystem, what does it contribute to? Are bobcats, you know, contributing to a healthy ecosystem? I'd like to think they are, because it kind of means that there's a healthy system when you have all of, you know, the animals in place doing what they do, you know, controlling rodents and squirrels and mice. And I think, you know, that's a benefit to have them. There's very little reports in the state of Illinois that they're taking domestic pets or impacting livestock. I mean, bobcat's pretty small, so they're going to have to expend a lot of energy to do anything to big livestock. Certainly chickens, you know, free-range chickens are going to be easy prey for them. And I know that that does happen. And there's already a law in place to address those type of nuisance cases. And from my understanding, the nuisance permit issues over the past years have been less than, you know, 9 or 10. So when you look at those numbers in the grand scheme of how many bobcats they estimate are in the state, it's really a really insignificant number that people are filing nuisance permits on. So what is the impact of having bobcats?
and you know, for, living in our
right.
state.
And how do you feel?
Is it good or is it bad? I mean,
and that's what you're saying you would like to know. And also, I wonder what your thoughts are on the fact that there's a new law that will now double how many permits will be issued per hunting season.
Yeah, you know, I think there's some confusion on that. When the IDNR decided on issuing 500 permits the first time, that was how they were reflecting their maximum allowable harvest. I know that I realize there's a cap of 350 of those 1,000 permits, but really, how do you control that? How do you control, you know, what happens when there's more hunting going on than the 350? My thought is, you know, how are they going to, what's the emergency provision to stop the hunt if they've gone over that limit?
The 350 permit limit. Have you reached out to the Department of DNR?
It's not a permit limit. It's actually a cap on the number of bobcat that are allowed to be killed. So they have the 1,000 permits that are going to be issued, and then the 350 that's the number of cats that are going to be able to be taken.
Ah, okay. That's the Illinois Bobcat Foundation's Jennifer Kuroda joining us from the Rockford area to sort of explain the foundation's positions. Jennifer, thanks for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Now here to talk more about hunting in Illinois, not just bobcats, is Mark Alessi. He's chief of the Illinois Department of Natural Resources Wildlife Division. Mark, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So, Mark, I wonder if you can, Jennifer sounded like there was a lot she wanted to have cleared up by the DNR. I wonder if you could explain just a little bit of the process of bobcat hunting, how many permits are issued, what the cap is on how many animals can be taken, those sorts of things for this upcoming hunting season.
You know, to begin the implementation of a hunting and trapping program for bobcats is a indication of a successful population being restored in Illinois. It's a conservation success story. We follow the North American model of conservation, and part of that, one of the principles of that model is that the wildlife, the harvest of wildlife are, you know, determined by science, and that's how we discharge wildlife policy. And in the case of bobcats, there's four primary metrics that we collect data on to show the distribution, the relative abundance, which is change over time, occupancy, and then the actual abundance, which is a study from 2009. The research on bobcats began really in the early 90s in Illinois, funded by wildlife restoration dollars, which is funded by sportsmen and women that buy hunting license, fishing license, and that buy firearms, ammunition, et cetera. And we have decades of projects in Illinois showing the conservation success of habitat restoration, the appropriate habitat coming back, and the bobcat numbers coming back.
Yeah. Do we have a sense of how big the population is, Mark?
The research in 2009 employed modeling based on different variables, and they ran multiple models, and the most conservative model showed an estimate of around 3,000. This is back in 2009.
And yeah, so a bit of time
model,
ago, right.
Mm-hmm. Right, and the most liberal model showed 7,000 models. So part of us having the season is to apply with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service for export authority, and we used an estimate of 3,000 to 5,000 bobcats statewide. Now, I'd like to point out that the research in the modeling was primarily in southern Illinois, and the estimate that we use is extremely conservative because we know they're found in suitable habitat outside the geographic area that they
studied. Right, because it's not just southern, northern,
right.
Then the western border of the state as well. And what about nuisance complaints? Are people seeing bobcats? Are you getting nuisance complaints about them?
We have gotten some over time. You know, they are not a significant population. You know, they're not a significant nuisance issue, human-wildlife conflict issue in terms of the broad scale of Illinois. However, the implementation of hunting and trapping programs is not due to just an animal becoming a nuisance or being a nuisance. You know, we like to manage situations before they get out of hand. And the implementation of the hunting and trapping season is we are harvesting animals. There's no doubt about that. It's an extremely conservative harvest. We have ongoing projects. We have a project occurring right now in western Illinois, looking at the bobcat population, and we're tapping on the brakes of population growth before they become a significant problem, either to landowners, to counties, or to the state.
And it looks like you've had pretty big demand for people wanting these permits.
We did. We had approximately 6,400. To put it in perspective for you, we have approximately 300,000 hunters and trappers in the state of Illinois. It varies between 320,000, give or take, every year. So, you know, a fairly significant number that applied for the permit. This year we saw a little bit over 4,000 apply for the permit. And there is confusion, you know, about the number of permits being issued and how that interacted with the legislation that was recently signed into law.
Yeah, can you clear that up for us?
Yeah, so the number of permits, after a hunting and trapping season, I think this is an important point. We collect data. You know, it's a very important data collection tool from a manager's perspective, because the data that we start to collect through a deer being harvested or a turkey being harvested, or in this case, a bobcat being harvested, is an additional data metric that we can use to analyze what the population is doing. And we're now getting information, based on hunter trapper success, which is an additional data point. And in the case of when we review that information after a hunting and trapping season, that information is used to set next year's regulations. So in the case of the bobcats, last year we saw 28% of the people that were awarded permits tagged a bobcat. And tagging a bobcat can be done in one of three ways. They can be hunted, they can be trapped, or they could be salvaged from a roadway, for example, which does occur. So the actual hunting and trapped side of that number is low, but based on last year's data point, 28% of the permittees successfully tagged a bobcat, and because that number was 28%, the thinking is you issue 1,000 permits, we're looking at approximately 280 bobcats being tagged this upcoming year based on last year's data point.
And so that to that point, Mark, I wonder, when we look at bobcats among the population, certainly not in the rank of most popular for hunting season. I wonder if you could we just have about a minute or two left, if we could just talk about what kind of people are looking for hunting season and in terms of what are the biggest numbers.
As far as bobcats?
No, just in general, how bobcats compare to other permits that you guys issue at DNR.
Deer is typically our number one activity in the state of Illinois for hunting and trapping. We have about 270,000 hunters in the state that do chase deer this time of the year. And then typically our next largest constituent group is going to be turkey hunters, waterfowl hunters, upland game hunters, like pheasant hunters, for example. Some of the species that we've seen dwindling numbers are quail hunters, squirrel hunters, rabbit hunters. Those species used to be hunted much more often in the past, but our constituency today is hunting deer, turkey, and waterfowl much more frequently than other small game and upland game. We've collected data both on the human dimension side and on the wildlife side, and we know the variables responsible for that. Access is a huge issue in Illinois. I mean, we're a significant agricultural state, and a lot of our land is privately owned, and it's very hard for people who don't have private land access to find a location to hunt. And,
sure.
You know, our focus is, and it's broader than hunting. You know, it's in this case, we're talking about hunting, but it could be hiking. It could be bird watching. It could be just going to open space for a day and having a picnic. And, you know, our focus is trying to expand public land opportunity for hunters and trappers, but for, you know, a broader constituency than that as well.
Yeah, lots of things for folks to think about as hunting season really gets into full swing here in the next month or so. Any advice for people as hunting season starts? What do you want the general population to know?
The primary thing I like to convey is that hunters and trappers are reminded to be safe. And, whether they're in a tree and they're using, they're using a safety vest, or, when they're out there, that they're being safe of where they're doing their hunting and trapping, keeping their equipment clean, making sure, you know, there aren't other people in the vicinity. And, you know, the primary thing to convey to the people is have a safe and enjoyable season. And, you know, we appreciate all their work they do for the department in terms of habitat management and support for the department.
That's Mark Alessi. He's chief of the Illinois Department of Natural Resources Wildlife Division. Mark, thanks a lot for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
That does it for us today. I'm Nyla Boodoo, broadcasting from Northwestern University's Medill School of Journalism in downtown Chicago. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.